Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the Cure Talks Cancer Podcast. Each week, we'll be hearing from patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, and healthcare professionals to do what Cure does best, provide cancer updates, research, and education.
In November 2006, the lives of the Marshall family changed dramatically when their matriarch, Liza, was diagnosed with stage 3 triple-negative breast cancer. Her husband, John Marshall, MD, who was chief of the Division of Hematology and Oncology at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital, professor of medicine and oncology, and director at the Otto J. Roush Center for the Cure of Gastrointestinal Cancer at Georgetown Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center, was without a doubt also impacted by the unexpected diagnosis and had to learn how to juggle between playing a caregiver and being a doctor.
The family, especially Liza, went through a long and stressful journey with her cancer. In the book Off Our Chest, set to be released in April 2021, both Dr. and Liza Marshall alternate sharing their perspective on this challenging time. OncLive and Cure sat down with the Marshalls to go beyond the pages of Off Our Chest and discuss how this triple-negative breast cancer diagnosis changed the lives of a patient and her gastrointestinal oncologist husband.
John, you have specialized in gastrointestinal oncology for quite a long time, and your book addresses how in past lectures you would emphasize the amount of breast cancer research that's been done versus that of GI cancers. Can you talk about your frustration here and the lack of awareness in GI cancers?
Yeah, it's something I've been preaching about almost my entire career. So we sort of felt like the stepchildren under the stairs, right? As a GI oncologist, our goal was to try and bring some of that research, bring some of that progress that we were jealously watching over there in the breast cancer world to our patients, because our patients weren't doing nearly as well. So I sort of took it on myself to share that message out there publicly and in writing, to really gripe about this sort of disparity in research funding.
You also mentioned very early on in the book that had there not been a lot of research funding for breast cancer, your wife could very well not be alive today. Could you talk about how your feelings shifted in the breast cancer awareness during all of this, and what more can still be done to boost awareness in GI cancers?
Yeah, be careful what you ask for, because sometimes you get bit in the end. And, you know, all of that complaining and sort of jealousy about look what they have over there and how special all their research is and breast cancer awareness months and racing for the cure, you know, that really got my back up. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, you know, we experience our own version of that. It comes and invades our house. And I have to share, I know Liza puts up with this, but it sort of felt like an impersonal assault, like the breast cancer gods were going to get me through her, right? They were going to come and get us. So you then start to take a new perspective of, well, why was I so angry? Why was that imbalance there in the first place? And how can we help level that? But at the same time, we enjoyed really remarkable success, right? I think without all of that research, without all of that progress that they had made, I don't think she'd be sitting here next to me today. So I'm incredibly grateful for all of that, despite still being jealous of it.
And so, Liza, you know, speaking of research and awareness, can you just comment on your appreciation for the work that your husband and his colleagues do in the cancer space each and every day?
Yeah, no, well, of course, I mean, I've lived with an oncologist since, you know, we were, I guess, in our late 20s, early 30s, and he's had a calling for cancer, I think, for a long time. So to see the work that not only he puts in, but many of our friends are oncologists, and of course, you know, we know many around the country, and it is such an incredible field. It is such an incredibly difficult field. And to see people who every day go in knowing that many of them are going to have to deliver bad news, that they're going to help not only the patient but the family through, you know, the worst time in their lives and an incredibly vulnerable time in their lives too. So I am in awe of what they do. I do think it's a calling. I think most people go into it because they really feel that they can do it, and there are many other people who can't. And so to see that's really wonderful. And obviously I was the beneficiary both at home and in my medical care from of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but she's less in awe when I haven't taken the trash out, for example. So that whole wonder thing goes away very quickly.
He's a human.
A fallible human, yes, right. I am. So it is those two worlds where, yeah, would work, you're one thing, but at
separate.
Home, you're not. You're just the husband.
Right. So with that, you know, for anybody to hear the words, you have cancer, comes as a shock. So first, kind of what ran through your head, but then moreover, what was it like to kind of have your husband be the one to reveal right. that diagnosis right. to you?
Well, I honestly thought he was joking when he first said it. I mean, we're on the phone just doing our morning thing, and he said, you know, you have cancer. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. And he said, no, but I could hear this catch in his voice. And then I was like, no, he's serious. Mm-hmm. And, what goes through your head? What do I do next? Am I going to die? How am I going to tell people? All of those things. And then there's just, I think, mass confusion. I think for anybody who gets to that, you know, who hears that, you can't really function. It takes a while. And that was the point at which I think I could hear panic in John's voice, but at the same time, he stepped in and said, okay, this is what we're doing next. And I didn't, we didn't have to talk to we did talk to another doctor, but we didn't, you're getting an MRI this afternoon, you're mm-hmm. getting, and you're getting blood tests. We're gonna do this. And so I was incredibly fortunate to have somebody there who immediately knew what the next steps were. As we went on, our roles shifted around. I think where the fact that we were married to each other, he was an oncologist, he was the colleague of the person that I was being treated by. So those were challenges that we confronted. Going down the road. I don't know that we ever resolved them. We wrote a book so that we could resolve them, I think. Longer term.
I was thinking about that morning. Every morning, every oncologist, a cancer care provider, goes through their stack of results. Mm-hmm. And some are good, but a lot are bad. And, we do what we have to do. We go through them. We inform the patient. And that morning, it was just a quirk because they copied me by error on my wife's pathology report, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm going through my stack, and there's a breast cancer biopsy report in a GI cancer stack, right? So I'm like, what's going on here? And so, but when I read that and figured out that it was my wife, that it was Liza, the feeling that I had has never really left me, because every morning, we did it this morning. There was a patient that had a bad scan last night, and I had to call her this morning to tell her about that. And now, since experiencing that on the receiving side of things, I kind of know what it's like, right? Mm-hmm. And so what I used to do, not routinely sounds wrong, but as part of the day, each one of those, I just feel so much more. And that's, again, part of why we wanted to share our story, is that I think both the patient side of things and the doctor side of things, we really need to look at what we're doing. And the better we can talk to each other, the better we can understand each other, I think the better our outcomes will be.
That's an excellent segue. John, would you be able to discuss some medical terms, Liza's diagnosis as well as prognosis? And being an oncologist, you knew what lied ahead of her. And how did you really balance being her caregiver, the husband, versus Dr. Marshall?
Yeah, I mean, I will, again, never forget, we were just getting dressed a morning and after showers, and Liza was bending over to look in to, I think, do some makeup or something. And I just looked over in the mirror and I saw that her breast had pulled. And I knew, because I knew, that was not good. That was not a good sign, but I didn't say anything. She was in the workup process anyway. And so I right then sort of knew this was not just a little thing. This was a big thing. And in the end, once the diagnosis came back, I think one of the things that struck me about her actual diagnosis in the biopsy was this lymphatic infiltration. We still really never defined where your primary tumor was, and it was just sort of this diffuse thing. So from medical terminology, that's more or less inflammatory breast cancer. And then later figuring out that it was triple negative. Now I will tell you, after that first biopsy report, that is the last piece of medical data I saw on Liza, because at that point I didn't want that job, and needed a different job, and I needed to be a caregiver. So I never went to tumor board when her case, even though I was invited, I never went to the tumor board where her case was presented. I never opened her chart just to see what was going on. I relied completely on the medical team at that point because, honestly, I didn't want to look. I wanted to be that husband and caregiver and not the doctor. I you know, you see so many docs. I mean, we have friends that where the doc is caring for their family. You know, they're the primary caregiver for the spouse or for the children or whatever. And I just don't know how you can do that. I don't know how you can maintain any sense of objectivity in that space. And that's so important for what we do. So I got out of the business of being her doctor right away.
Well, we kind of that goes the other way too, because up until that point, I joke, but John kept telling me every time I had anything wrong with me, he said, "Well, you need to get a real disease." And he would tell the kids, "You're fine." I have people that are really sick, and so anyway, we kind of joke that I then went out to get a real disease.
Our kids learned very quick that they didn't come to dad with medical problems; right. They went to their lawyer mother for medical stuff and. If they called me, they were really worried if they called me, but usually, because I was like, get out of here. You'll get better. You're fine.
So with that, Liza, what was it like to kind of have your husband, who's an oncologist, and having that knowledge so that you could make decisions about your treatment? And I think you had mentioned in the book, it wouldn't be all that bad, but at the same time, you've always taken care of your own care and managed your health. So. Mm-hmm. How did you two kind of straddle that line between oncologist and caregiver and you deciding what you wanted?
Right. Well, I don't know if we actually succeeded in doing it. I mean, I think it was a day-by-day decision. I certainly relied a lot on John's knowledge and his, and some of that was oncologist, some of that was caregiver, some of it was, can you take notes? And then can you translate them for me afterwards, which I think is true for many spouses and just general caregivers in a doctor's office with an oncologist. You need somebody there with you who, you hope has done a little research and knows what you have and can ask your questions and then write them down and come back with that. I got a second opinion, which would not have even occurred to me, except John said, of course, you have to have a second opinion. That's, I tell all my patients to get a second opinion. So there were some things that I think steps that he very much laid out and we just did, but as we got farther into it, and I think his decisions got more complicated, there's a point at which for a cancer patient, it's presented to you as a personal choice, an option. You can do this trial, or you can take this medication this way, and you don't really have any idea what they're talking about or what the ramifications of your decision are going to be. But at the same time, you're the one who has to make the choice. And I think at that point, John tried very much to step back, and I can't tell you to this day whether that was the right decision or not. I didn't want him telling me what to do, but at the same time, I wanted him to tell me what to do. I wanted somebody to tell me what to do.
Right.
As I say, I'm not sure we succeeded in straddling the line, but we both did our best, which is, I suppose, all anybody can ask in any of these situations of each other.
One of my favorite parts of the book that you wrote, because we wrote alternating chapters, was that scene when it's a real scene, when you were getting information from the surgeon, Dr. Willie, and I guess Manetta or Claudine was in the room as well, and I was in the room. And so there was this doctor discussion going on that I was playing in, and you were like, what are they talking about?
Literally sitting on a lower chair, and they were all sitting on the edges of desks. And so literally this conversation is
going
literally over my head, and they're just talking to each other. Well, she could do this, and she could do that. And I was like, but at the same time, I knew I was very blessed to have these three doctors standing there talking about very accomplished breast doctors, he wasn't a breast doctor, two very accomplished breast doctors and another oncologist who was my spouse, mm-hmm. talking about what was the best treatment for me going forward. So,
and it was
one
of those things that was like, we just had to fast forward to, okay, then this happens and this happens. So, and then at the end, it was fell back to me. I realized that I could see Liza sitting there saying, I'm not understanding this. Mm-hmm. And so you, as physicians, one of the reasons why I hope docs will read this book too, is that we are often in that situation where we are talking to people that is our prime audience, that we're trying to teach them enough so that they can be involved in a shared decision making, right? And they're not understanding anything we're saying, right? Their brain's over here thinking about something else. Mm-hmm. And we think, okay, we've checked that box, but mm-hmm. you know, having participated on that on a bunch of levels, I realize just how far we fail on that and mm-hmm. or how often we fail on that. And I'm hoping that we can do a better job in closing that gap.
Absolutely. And so with that, Liza, talking about the decision-making process, what led you to want to partake in research?
Well, I kind of joke. In the first place, I had drunk the Kool-Aid. I mean, you know, John had been talking about clinical research for years, but I'm a community volunteer type of person. I really believe in people working together for the common good. And that sounds sort of pie in the sky, but maybe it's lots of small steps, but it's lots of people enrolling in clinical research. And I knew enough about it to know that I wasn't getting a placebo. I mean, I think there's a lot of misinformation out there about clinical research, mm-hmm. and, you know, you're going to get lesser a level of care if you go into a research program. And I knew that none of that was true, that I was going to get standard of care mm-hmm. or something, you know, hopefully better. So there was a selfish component that I was going to, it might give me a better chance of surviving this, but there was also a community piece of it that I really believe that we're not going to make any progress in cancer and in many diseases unless people are willing to be part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, from my end, I was the associate director for clinical research for Lombardi Cancer Center. And so I was in charge of all research activities that occurred that now my wife's participating in. So in theory, it was a real interesting conflict of interest, right? And it brought to mind to me one of the things, and we talk about this in the book a bit, about what our world is like. And one of the requirements of an NCI, Comprehensive Cancer Center, is a certain percentage of patients need to go on to clinical trials. And so here, my wife was contributing to our metrics, right? And three times, actually, a bunch of trials. So it really made me look at, from my end, what are trials about? What are their goals? How much does a patient understand about those trials? How much do we understand as we sell them to other folks and offer them up? So it is the only way we move forward. There's no question that's true. So it's of paramount importance. But it also made me look at our research operation and those sorts of things differently, having now experienced it as a consumer. Mm-hmm.
And John, going back to more medical terminology, could you discuss Liza's treatment and especially some of the multidisciplinary approaches that were taken?
Yeah, so she really needed multidisciplinary approach because of the inflammatory or near inflammatory nature of her cancer. You know, the first big discussion is chemo first versus surgery first. And back then, neoadjuvant chemo was not a standard at all. It was just becoming one. And in fact, one of the trials that she was offered was just that, which today, if Liza walked in with that same cancer, would be the standard. She would get neoadjuvant chemotherapy. It would, based on her response to that chemotherapy, she would be on I-SPY 2, mm-hmm. which is a study that looks mm-hmm. at neoadjuvant chemo based on her molecular markers, triple negative molecular markers, and specific treatment for that. And then determined how much chemo she would get after. So that's what would have happened today. But of course, we turned that study down, the positive one. The study we went into, or she went into, was a more dose-dense kind of four-arm trial. It was a CLGB Alliance study, or SWOG study. And all of the arms were sort of investigational, but more intense AC followed by T. Than is currently given. And so in the end got randomized to six cycles of AC. And after, was it two or three, you're like, and I have to have how many more of these? And really was quite a challenge. I mean, the last couple of cycles of that, you know, you appreciate what you do to people. You think you appreciate what you do to people when you're given chemotherapy. But, you know, watching your wife walk to church in pain because mm-hmm. of the hand-foot syndrome. Yeah. And you realize when you go to the doctor, you say, it's not that bad. But then when you watch him walk down the street, you realize it is that bad. And so that whole experience of more aggressive chemotherapy also should teach us all a lesson about, you know, what our patients are going through in the name of being cured. You get why they're doing it, right? You understand that there's nothing more. You have to be alive in order to have quality of life. Positive or negative. Okay. So the first step, you know, the first step is to live, to survive what you're doing. And we have this mindset of aggressiveness. So the trial she went on to was a very aggressive study that in the end, you know, you suffered through, but you are here. Let's put it that way.
And I think patients do too. I mean, yeah. I think mm-hmm. patients very, it's hard not to feel I have to do everything. You know, the more I suffer, the more likely it is mm-hmm. that I'm going to make it through. And that's, I think, you know, has been proven not to be true, but it's still hard to get over that feeling that, you know, the worse this is, the better I must be doing.
Right.
Yeah. There's an expectation even, right, that I've got to suffer. The doctor, right. patients will come in and say, you know, I didn't have many side effects. Does that mean it's not going to work? And you're like, no, that's good.
Okay.
That's good. That's good. We'll keep it right there.
And John, you've always had a very heavy workload, traveling a lot, working long hours, and obviously a lot of that had to change when you became Liza's caregiver. Do you have any advice that you can give to other oncologists who perhaps have to put on the caregiver hat also?
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to express in this book as an old oncologist is that our jobs are hard. Whether you're in community practice, academic practice, whatever you do, our jobs are hard. We all want to cure cancer, and we're in a hurry to do it. And to do that, you have to push on the research side. You have to be there to care for your patients because you know how scared they are and how upset they are and how sick they are and how complicated things are. And so it's not like you can turn it off. And, you know, in an academic life, yeah, it's multitasking with travel and writing and research and patient care. But every one of us who's in this business of cancer care has got a hard, multitasked, stressful life. And when Liza got cancer and we were going through all of this, it sounds crazy, but I was in a way grateful that she got her care at our hospital, because then I could be in clinic, and then when she was in clinic, I, in my white coat, walk down yep. two halls and go sit and be her husband for a little while, and then get up and go back and be Dr. Marshall again. So that made it efficient, made it possible. But that's back to the point of, like, if you're, I'm also the breadwinner, right? Our insurance comes through me, right? So my job. And so you think about all the couples out there that, you know, it's often the patient who is the one going, you know, who's got the insurance. So how do you maintain in the face of all of that, the complexity that the individual couple has to go through? It's really, really remarkable. But so, yeah, I had to slow down a little bit, but I think Liza's still mad. I didn't slow down that much. Right?
I mean, he did slow down.
Yeah, so even, you know, while you were going through treatment, I mean, you pick on me. I mean, I appropriately, that I would sort of drive by and wave and then go back and see patients, right?
That was more the travel. I was sort of, you know, I had treatment on Tuesday and it's Thursday. Oh, you're going on a trip. Well, good. How nice for you.
Yeah. And it was the push and pull of all of those things. I was not a good caregiver.
No,
I mean,
that's not true.
I was certainly not the ideal caregiver. I mean, a good caregiver does research. They would have been welcome. They would have gone to their wife's tumor board if invited. They, you know, they would have looked into the trial more that you went into and stuff, and been there and slowed down so that I could be there with the kids and all. But I didn't as much as I needed to. And I do regret that, but at the same time, at the time, it just, part of that was my keeping running. It wouldn't catch up to us, right? Mm-hmm. If I just kept, you know,
we both felt that way.
Well, live normally, yeah. Live as normal as we can, and then maybe it won't catch us. Was part of our mission.
Right. And so another chapter of the book, you talk about telling your children and your family, and we all know that's a difficult conversation to have. So can you talk about how you went about telling the kids? And then moreover, do you have advice for others who also have to have that tough conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I'm hesitant to give advice in those situations because everybody's different, right. And every family is different, and every child and parent is different. But I think for us, I mean, we kind of joke as people have started to read the book, they say, oh my gosh, this book is so just incredibly honest. And you know, we pretty much put everything out there. And so that we had a conversation before we talked to our children. It was the day I had been diagnosed, and they had been at my parents for the day while I did my testing, and they didn't know what was wrong yet. And so we talked about how to approach them, and, you know, we gave a very factual, mom has cancer. We used the word cancer, which I think for us was important to do. We didn't want them to hear from anybody else. And, you know, it's hard to keep something like that a secret, particularly as involved as we were in our children's school and our children's lives. And we said, you know, she's doing these treatments. This is, we expect everything will be fine. I don't even know if we said we'll let you know if anything changes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We realized later, actually, as we were writing the book, that we never really updated them. So they actually were surprised to find out later on how dire it was at points. And I don't know if we did the right thing or the wrong thing. They seem okay. But who knows?
Well, the jail time has been short.
Yeah. But it's, you know, I think, I really do believe in most things in life that being straightforward with people and honest, you don't have to give them every piece of information, particularly the ones that are really scary. But I think not telling people almost always ends up being worse for everybody because they feel you kept a secret from them. They don't know what they've missed. They don't know what other secrets, you know, it damages trust. And so I really, you know, I hope we did it right. They seem okay. But you know, I think people do have to have to assess their own situations too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, our kids are cancer kids, right?
Yeah.
You know, so they dinner table kind of discussions about patients or, mm-hmm. You know, friends would call. They joke always that some friend out of the blue calls. And our daughter always jokes, well, they must have cancer because why else are they calling, right? So they're just wanting some advice.
And she's always right. I say, oh, I haven't heard from you so long. And then she's like, cancer.
So they know about cancer. Our children have been on rounds. They've get it, and they know that people die of cancer. They mm-hmm. knew even then. They had friends whose parents had died of cancer. So so from that end, it was easier, I think, for us than many. But as Liza says, it's individualized by your own kids and your own environment. But one piece of advice I've taken away from that I now share with really all my patients is tell one story. Don't have a story for work and a story for the kids and a story for the neighbors. You don't have to blog it or write a book about it, but you know, tell one story so that don't spend all that energy, who knows what, and, you know, secret stuff and all of that. It's hard to hide cancer, really. And the stuff that happens to you. So just coming out early kind of helps. But it's also, part of this is a personal thing for me too, and I know Liza and I both experienced parents with cancer, my mother dying when I was young with cancer. And back in those days, I don't even think there was color TV, but there was, you didn't tell kids about stuff. You know, you didn't share your health stuff. So we didn't really know. All of a sudden, mom's dead, right? I knew she had cancer, but all of a sudden she's dead. And so I never as a child had that, you know, debrief with my mom before she died, right? The goodbyes, and there were no videos and things that you would save or letter writing, that wasn't done. So I sort of taken this as a mission, and it's crazy, but to like make sure parents are doing this, to make sure, and that's where it comes to our end of life management that we never do as well as we should, to make sure that people are aware and in the loop, because you leave that legacy too. And we, you know, we learned it with our kids, we learned it with our parents, so it's important.
Definitely. And John, so I know you'd mentioned that your kids were kind of cancer kids and they were aware of cancer and what happens, but obviously a lot of parents don't have that opportunity. So as most don't. But as a physician, Do you have any advice for other parents, maybe more so from a clinical aspect of, like, for example, we tell people, don't say the word sick. So is there anything like that that you could offer for other patients that have to have this conversation?
I just think having an openness about what's going on. I think word choice is, you know, kids today, if whatever we tell them, they then run off and look it up on the internet. Mm. So, you know, no matter how old they are nowadays. So, you know, there's not really those kinds of secrets. They can, if they're interested, they can figure it out. Mm-hmm. If they hear that, you know, you can ask them anything, you can ask me anything, this is what we think today. You know, if you want to go to a clinic with us, you can, post-COVID. If you want to, you know, whatever, we're trained. Most kids will say, you're okay? Okay, I'll see you. And then mm-hmm. they go back to do their homework or they go out and play, right? Some kids will be anxious and nervous, but those are the kids actually that probably need some help. Maybe mm-hmm. the therapy goes to them and not the patient or the caregiver. So, you know, recognizing our differences and how we're dealing with it emotionally, I think, is important. And mm-hmm. this kind of goes to the ripple of a cancer diagnosis. So when we as oncologists have somebody in the office, two people, right? It's usually a spouse and a patient or a friend. And whatever you're saying there, we don't really remember that, like, now 100 people are going to hear what we just had to say, mm-hmm. right? And so I often will even start conversations to say, like, how many people know you're in this office right now? Because that'll tell you a lot. No one, which means there's trouble. Yep. Or, yeah, there's a whole bunch of people know I'm here and we're waiting to hear what we have to say, right? So then that's a little more healthy, in my opinion. So making sure that those communication lines are healthy is, I think, very, very important.
Well, I was going to say, too, I think one advantage of being open about it with people is you need support. And if people don't know about it, they can't support you. And I think it really, you know, John uses the term, I think that cancer is a team sport. And it really is. I mean, not just your medical team, but your whole social team and everything else. And so I think there's a lot to be said for more than just talking about to your children, but mm-hmm. being open about what your situation is and letting people help you, because people do want to help you and support you. So.
And this is where we were so spoiled, right? Because we knew all the people that were taking care of us, mm-hmm. right? So we honestly didn't really have to think much. We didn't have to research much. We didn't even have to wait on hold to schedule scans because people were just magically doing it for us. Mm-hmm. And so we could, you know, be part of our, you know, our team helped us in so many ways. And what I learned, it took 10 years later to realize, is that we can't provide that level of care for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, we can try all we want, but no healthcare system can deliver the kind of spoiled, cared-for care that we received while you were going through this, as hard as we try. And we do try. That's the part of the point, too. It's what makes us tired. That's what burns us out, is trying to be that for all patients that walk in. The only answer there is just keep doing the best you can, but recognize where you're falling down and make sure you're... you know, band-aiding everything you can band-aid.
It's so well said. Mm. John, do you have any key messages from Off Our Chest that you would like to share from an oncologist perspective?
Yeah, I think the first and most striking thing for me was the empathy we feel for other people. Most cancer doctors and nurses and everyone in the field is there because they're called to be there. It's not an easy line of work, so you're there because you want to be. Your heart's telling you need to be there. But you also have to maintain an objectivity in order to deliver the best medical care to anybody. So I used to have this vision in my head that there was this half-built wall, and then I was on this side and the patient was on that side, and I could shake their hand and I could examine them, but they were over there and I was over here. And after Liza's diagnosis and our experience going through all of this, I couldn't find that wall anymore. I was over there and giving out emails and trying to be responsive. And so that line of wanting to be that empathetic, there for you all the time caregiver, which is what our calling is, with going crazy, right? Because you can't be it for everybody. The emotional load that takes is really... that dance is what's leading me to burnout. It leads others to burnout. So I think we have to watch ourselves, not be cold and callous, because then we're not doing the job right either, but not being so far over there that we burn out. emotionally. So everybody's going to have to draw that line and develop that strategy, but we have to acknowledge it's there. We're not superhuman. We are human. And what we do every day is the most human thing that you can do, and that's care for others. So to me, that's really number one.
And similarly, what are you hoping that patients and caregivers can take away from the book?
I'll speak for patients and maybe caregivers as well, I think. You know, we've tried to be really practically straightforward and honest about what we've been through. And I think for many people, again, you go into this and you're me, like, I have no idea, you know, talk about the wall. I mean, I'm over this wall and I have no idea how I got here and why I'm here and what anything is on this side of the wall. So, you know, we hope, I think, that to a certain extent, it's just a lifting of the curtain, a little education about, you know, tests and it's, you know, and conversations with your doctor and conversations with your family, how to approach these things, ways in which you might approach them. You know, I think there's also this, the broader sort of, you know, building empathy, not only for cancer patients and caregivers, but people who in your life are going through a hard time. I mean, that they do need, that the support that we can offer each other is, really what gets us all through, I think, at the end of the day. And so I think it's a little bit of empathy for each other about the situations that we're all in and recognizing that what people look like on the outside may not be what's going on with them on the inside. Both, again, caregivers, doctors, everybody. I mean, I think everybody fits that mold a little bit.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So one way I like to kind of bring things together, looking back for each of you, what is one thing you know now that you wish you knew before the week of November 2006?
Mine may sound a little morose, but, I wish I noted it was coming, I guess. I wish we all, this is the morose part, I wish we all knew when we were going to die, right? Our lives would be different if we knew when things were going to end. And you would live your life completely differently knowing that. And so, you know, there is, I say, you know, and I do really believe this, there is a blessing in a sense in a diagnosis like this, because it is brought home to you that you're not going to be around forever and you don't know how long that's going to be. But it does, I mean, I say it's very trite sounding, but you really do learn to appreciate, maybe not every single day. There are days I do not appreciate, but you know, I've, somebody says, how old are you? And I'm like, I'm 57, and I am thrilled to be 57. I mean, that is a blessing, right? I have plenty of friends who didn't make it that far. So, I don't mean to be bleak about it, but it actually, to me, it actually brings more joy into my life that I have looked this in the face. And, you know, things happen to people every day. And so I think appreciating what we have now and, the life we're living at the moment is really important, and it's in a sense a blessing to have had that brought into focus for me, I think.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's sort of the power of words, what we say, how we say it, and coupled to, you know, there's so much we don't know in our field scientifically. We say a lot of things with certainty. Some new phase 3 randomized trial comes out and we all say, this is the only way forward. Well, no, it's not. It's a possible way forward. And we become dogmatic and almost rigid in our thinking about what's the best, and what, you know, guidelines do that to us as well. And when you sort of look behind the scenes to how we evolve those guidelines, what's the science, it's not perfect. We are making guesses. We're making assumptions. We put people through things, fingers crossed, hopeful, but we say it in a way that's certain. And I think the power that we have, the power that we wield in maybe the most vulnerable and scary time of a patient's life, all the level of complexity that needs to go into the decision making, shared or not, should make us all a little humble, honestly, that, we're doing good stuff, we're doing God's work, but at the same time, God's work comes with humility, and if we approach it that way, if we acknowledge the uncertainty, if we acknowledge the power of the words that we're saying, I think we do a better job.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Cure Talks Cancer podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps to hear every episode, or visit curetoday.com/podcasts. The Cure Talks Cancer podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, the indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com and find us on Twitter at @cure_magazine or Facebook at @curemagazine.